Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM program director Allison Sansoni chats with playwright and screenwriter Sarah Gubbins, who most recently adapted the screenplay for the film Shirley, starring Elizabeth Moss as Shirley Jackson. This program originally took place July 6th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name's Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here tonight and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here tonight to discuss Shirley Jackson and the new film Shirley, now streaming, starring Elizabeth Moss and written by tonight's guest, Sarah Gubbins. The film, much like the work of Jackson herself, is a haunted house story, imagining the writer and her husband as the malevolent spirits who prey upon a young couple that they take in. It's a portrait of a brilliant, eccentric woman whose interrogation of domesticity and the intimacy of imagination has made her one of our most enduring writers. Sarah is a native of Chicago, where our museum is located, in case you're joining us from elsewhere. And her plays have been produced by the Public Theater, New York Theater Workshop, Goodman, Steppenwolf Theater Company, and many others. She partnered with Transparent's Jill Soloway on bringing Chris Krause's book, I Love Dick, to the TV screen, and is writing for television and book projects in Los Angeles. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So good to be here tonight.
Tell us first how you came to the writing of Shirley Jackson and from there to this project.
I mean, those are two different questions. I'm sure, like so many other of your viewers and other Shirley Jackson fans, I first was exposed to Shirley Jackson in high school when I read The Lottery, and obviously it's just one of those short stories that you never forget. Maybe it's because I was a sophomore in high school, I just didn't really pursue any of her other works. And it wasn't until I got to college and I was in a class, I was sitting theater, and there's this class that was like adaptation for the stage. And we chose somebody had chose this really strange book called We've Always Lived in the Castle and had to kind of like figure out how to do a stage adaptation as a class project. And that's the moment that I think Shirley really entered my brain and would never let go. You know, I mean, there was just no, I'd never encountered writing like hers. And so later on, after I moved out to LA, I was looking for a project with this producer, Sue Nagel. And we just were really kind of wanting to figure out something that we might pursue as a feature film, and a couple of, you know, I was reading a couple of things, and a friend of mine who lives in Sag Harbor, where the author of the book Shirley lives, I guess they had gone on a walk or something, and she was telling him about how she was finishing a manuscript, and literally he, you know, sent me the manuscript, said, I think you'd love this, and it was just like, from that moment on, I just really had to do it. And so it was a long development process of the script, because I don't know if I'm over answering your question here, but because I knew that I didn't want to do a direct adaptation, but there is a part in the film where Shirley is attempting to write a novel. It's not her first novel, but I would say it's probably one of pivotal in the sense that it kind of changed the trajectory of her writing. And so in prepping the script, I read all of Shirley's work and just really, really was moved by this this novel, Hangs a Man. And it kind of stood out as a reader of kind of like really encapsulating her voice as a novelist. And so the more research I did, the more I started to piece together just her trajectory into being a novelist, and this the book surely allowed me kind of an arena to play with those ideas, purely fictional, but solely informed by my reading of her work and my reading of her correspondence. And Ruth Franklin's marvelous biography wasn't out at the time when I first started writing the script. So I was reading some older biographies, and yeah, I think that's kind of how the project was born. I was really taken by this moment when she has just written The Lottery and is both kind of catapulted to some kind of literary fame, of course, but also some notoriety. And to have like that be the story that was the cause of so many, the most New Yorker, you know, canceled subscriptions. And also to have like bags and pounds of hate mail delivered to their Bennington house in response to that. It really does, you know, take a toll. I would imagine takes a huge toll on you and your confidence as a writer. So to have that be the moment that she kind of then aligns or has the bravery or the ferocity to then start on this other path as this really influential novelist, I thought for me it would be a movie that I wanted to see. I didn't know how many other people want to see it, but for me, I was very interested in that. And it felt like a great kind of encapsulized moment of not just somebody trying to write, which of course is always feels like it's takes place in a haunted house. It's a horrific, you know, gory event, but that she would also be moving towards, you know, formally kind of a different arena. So yeah.
You alluded to this a moment ago, but this isn't a biopic. It sort of weaves Jackson's life, parts of her life together to sort of create this moment out of time. So how did you approach building the characters that would inhabit this world?
Well, I mean, I had some, you know, you're playing with both the performance of the fantasy of and a tiny bit of research of two of the four main characters in it. And I think, so that was great. And I think in terms of finding the voice of, and I tend to enter my scripts a lot through dialogue, just I kind of have to wait until I can hear what people are saying. And that was really aided by many of Shirley and Stanley's letters are in the Library of Congress. So I was able to read her kind of more intimate presentation and knew that I was dealing with someone that was both terribly witty and a little raunchy and very vulnerable. And then also alternately to hear Stanley be such this kind of impresario, I think would be the best way to, you know, and that their intellectual life of the mind was so vibrant and it really kind of helps let you know they have this huge appetite for not just literature and folklore and music, but food. Really enjoyed food. So, you know, you can kind of start to assemble a character that way. And then the younger couple, I mean, in essence, part of the fun for me was that idea of having loved Shirley's work as a reader. I mean, Rose and I were very much aligned in this idea of what it might, the fantasies we might hold if given the opportunity to board with Shirley Jackson. And probably the deep insecurities we might feel, or the fascination, or the startling disappointments, you know. But I think that desire, as somebody who esteems a writer, to be near them, to have an encounter with them, and then more importantly, to in some way impact them, and impact their imagination, and maybe be memorialized by showing up, you know, in their work, which I think ultimately is definitely something that Rose is desiring, among many other things, from Shirley.
Yeah. One of the things that kept coming back to me as I watched the film was the idea of the intimacy of teaching someone something. So Shirley's, you know, Stanley was, you know, considered himself, at least in the film, at least he seemed to consider himself Shirley's, you know, teacher. Shirley teaches Rose, the young woman who, in case there are people watching who haven't seen the film, who comes to live with Shirley and their husbands, so much. And that's a really easy area to tip things over into manipulation. And did you feel that Shirley was genuinely trying to help Rose, or was she toying with her?
I've heard Elizabeth Moss answer this question a bit, and I have to agree with her. I think it's very, very complicated. I think that at the time she is genuinely hoping to help Rose, either experience another part of herself or kind of come into a realization that, you know, her future can hold something that isn't bound just by what society is telling her. And as Shirley is an example of somebody who's married to a kind of a revered faculty member at Bennington, and having Rose now, the young pregnant wife of a very young man who's just come to start teaching at Bennington, that there is kind of a preconceived idea of like what a faculty wife will be, and just surely by pure example is trying to show Rose, yes, it doesn't have to be this. However, I do think she does manipulate her, and probably more consciously than she'd like to admit, because she's searching for something, and she's searching for the embodiment of an idea that she probably already knows. And that's who exactly her heroine will be in Hangsman. But I do find that when there is something external that you can graft to, it helps in that creative process of trying to set about, putting words on a page. And I think there's a closeness that the two women form, as Rose then so readily accepts the Shirley's need for a quote unquote muse. I mean, it's kind of a, I don't know what you think, it's kind of a perversion of the idea of muse, because muse is usually, you know, somebody who's going to awaken something in you. And I think that there's a lot of ways in which Shirley is Rose's muse. But I do think you had a very simple question, but I do think that she uses Rose in a lot of ways. And I think some of it is very knowing, and some of it is very primal, and her ability to trust other women, her ability to see herself as beautiful. Rose is able to help her feel those things. And then ultimately to feel betrayed and rejected and, you know, let down by someone as well. So I think it's, yeah, I think it's all of those things, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it would be really easy to paint Rose as sort of this ingenue who then falls under the spell of an older woman who used to describe herself as a witch to reporters.
Yes.
You know, but Rose has power over Shirley as well. And that's, I feel like that sort of female power was something that was just starting to be discussed at the time that the film was set.
No, I agree. And I also think that there was a part of me that had the desire to depict Shirley and Rose's relationship in alignment to the way in which you may do a reading of so many of Shirley's heroines. They, you know, Shirley has the ability to kind of write these, and when you first meet the heroine of Hangsman, you know, Natalie is this, she's kind of bratty, she's a little bored, she really doesn't like her mother, she wants to be seen as older than she is, but she feels put out by it, she's scared to go to college, but she wants, you know, like she seems a little petty, she's a little, you know, and yet then this is the person that you are you know, being subjected to bring you through the story. And it turns out that you know, she's haunted by the subconscious and terrors that she can't quite articulate. And I think ultimately you feel such empathy for her. And I think that's just reoccurring all over Shirley's work. You know, the ways in which, you know, the heroine of We've Always Lived in the Castle, Meerkat, is just, I don't want to spoil it, but she has done something pretty awful. And yet she is your unreliable narrator. And she again is kind of petty, self-involved, vain, you know, judgmental, and also terribly magical. I think that's definitely something that Shirley's work as a whole is approaching. And because we have so little time in a film, and, you know, but I do think that idea is something that really preoccupied all of her writing.
The when you describe, you know, adapting the novel, it's an onion, right? So you're adapting the novel, which takes from Shirley's work, but isn't a standard biography. You know, so how did you manage to deal with all of that when you were doing your own research and depict a woman who had lived, who has living children, but who is fictionalizing in some way?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think you're describing it very well. It always was an onion. There was always more layers. I don't know. I mean, I think I knew that formally. I knew the film would take place during one academic year. It was going to be a very impactful year for Shirley, and I knew where she was coming from, and I had an idea of where she was going in terms of being able to deliver that novel to Stanley at the end. Because I do think that in so many ways, this is also a story of a marriage, the story of an artistic marriage. And it also was, in essence, like a crime scene, you know? Like, and we were detectives, and we being like the whole film production company, every contributor of the project, every step of the way. But when I was writing it, I knew that I had Hangsman. So it was about trying to figure out the steps that led to it, or what might be leading to it, and what kind of realizations Shirley was going to be making along the way about Natalie, and about, you know, the just where the plot goes. And Shirley, again, while she's not in Hangsman really writing about this Paula Weldon, who it's an actual person that disappeared and was a Bennington student, and she did disappear in the Green Mountains, you know, I'm certain that she was influenced by that in some way, shape, or form. I don't believe she set out maybe as stringently as to retell that story, but so I kind of feel like there were all of these elements from which to be drawing clues, you know? Clues from her own biography, clues from her work. And I think, you know, people that are Shirley fans can see ways in which we're also talking about in the film the way in which writers, empirically so, are adapting scenarios and characters from their actual life and putting them into fiction. Even though we see maybe Shirley's not, you know, maybe the mushroom scene isn't going to show up in Hangsman, there are touches of, you know, Meerkat's preoccupation with the death cap mushroom and We've Always Lived in the Castle. So we're starting to see ways in which her worlds, which she draws from the world and puts that in her fiction, which I found an interesting aspect of the film, you know, to explore another way. It's almost like interrogating a writer's imagination, which is of course impossible to ever know. And it's also impossible to ever express, but if you were to try, what would it look like?
Every writer's least favorite question, right? Where do you get your ideas?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Not entirely sure. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's, in some ways, it's the hope of the film was always that we would have an opportunity to kind of explore some of those aspects of the dramatic imagination. Yeah.
Yeah. What did writing this film teach you about writing?
Well, it reinforced a lot. I think in particular, the way in which a screenplay becomes a finished film, this project probably more than any other has taught me that there are so many stages of kind of reinvention. You know, there's so many stages of writing when you think about a film. There's the writing of the screenplay, there's what we're able to actually shoot, and the crazy alchemy of finding locations and having enough light and resources and brilliant acting. Because once the actors step in, I mean, I didn't necessarily write the film with Elizabeth Moss in mind or Michael Stahlbarg, but my God, I can't, you know, when we were casting, I couldn't even think of anybody else in the world to play those parts. And then to see the ways in which, even if they're speaking dialogue or even if the scenarios are the same, what an actor is going to bring is unexpected and untangible. So there's a rewriting that's happening there in the performance and in the cinematography and in the direction, you know. And then you go to editing, and there's a whole other moment of revision. Tamar Khalid did our score and was our composer. And I don't know, the movie would be an entirely different movie if we had a different composer. And thankfully, you know, she really wanted to do it. But, and this is to say nothing of in a director's eye, you know, which of course is a given. So I think for me, what was reinforced about writing, to your real original question, is the necessity of revision. And yet there are maybe two scenes in the movie that, despite all of the drafts and all of the notes and all of the adaptation for, you know, physical demands and the cutting room floor, remained intact from the first draft to the end. And that is the mushroom scene. And there are parts, the ending scene, mm-hmm. And the introduction of Shirley at the party, and a couple of the dinner scenes with Stanley.
But that's all out of 2 hours.
Yeah, and I'm talking about from the first draft.
Yeah.
Because I probably, by the time our full team was assembled, I mean, Sue Nagel and I were with the script, and then we brought Josephine on to direct, which was just, I mean, I could, that in and of itself is a total reinvention of the film when you are working with the director that Josephine Decker, her sensibility brings to a project. But I probably rewrote the script for 2 solid years before we even started production.
Yeah.
It's a good time. Everyone should do it. Maybe it's just me. I've heard it's not, but,
yeah,
but when you think that, yeah,
that was the other thing when I was like, you really depict just how unpleasant writing and just how, you know, how difficult when it's not going well, just how miserable it is.
well, you, Allison, were given an introduction to this Q&A tonight, and you were so eloquently just talking, encapsulating the film, and your summary was like so great. And I'm thinking, I just know how hard that is to just pick the perfect way of describing succinctly this, you know. And it's I hear tell that there are writers that enjoy writing.
Never met a one.
I never believe them.
yeah. We had a writer in for a program about a year ago, and a younger writer, and she was talking to some high school students, and one of them asked her, "Do you ever think of giving up?" And she said, "Oh yeah, this morning."
Yeah, yes,
all the time. Yeah.
Yes. I don't enjoy writing, but I love having written.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some days, other days it's just,
Exactly. Exactly. Tell me a little bit about your theater education, your experience in the Midwest. I'm honor bound to mention the UW Badgers here.
Okay.
My association will expel me.
Okay.
But you also studied at Northwestern, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did it twice, actually. I did my undergrad work in theater there, and then I went back several years later and received an MFA from their writing for the stage and screen program. So that was cool. And that was just predominantly a writing program. But the theater, you know, the undergrad theater stuff was great. I mean, that, I think, you know, and you do it again, you learn some things, but having a theater background, I should say that I was a disastrously awful actor in that I always was myself and never any Chekhov character that I was trying to impersonate. But
you're
just having to do having to do that as a writer, like I very much feel like I approach my writing from the body of a character, and that is very helpful in a lot of ways, because you know everything that is spoken is in some way an action that I know an actor later on is going to ask me, why am I saying this, or what's going on here, or where have I come from, the given circumstances. And so I think that's kind of like foundational to me in terms of where the theater has played a larger role. And then after all of that, well, between undergraduate and graduate school, I worked a lot in Chicago theater as a dramaturg. And that's, some people know what that word is and some people don't, but it's basically I worked a lot in new plays. And so you're kind of like an editor, a little bit of a research brain. You are the person that kind of holds the integrity of the production's intentions. So if the lighting designer is trying to do this, the director's trying to do this, you know, you're kind of the person that holds all that together. And I think that really, that kind of working in plays so much and trying to understand the formal structures that really make for dramatic action or, you know, just wowing theatrical experiences, that's just stuff that I've really carried into my television and feature work.
So what have you found that there's a common thread that attracts you to particular stories, particular types of people, particular characters? Is there sort of a through line in your work?
And people have said it. I think I'd like to do a lot more before I, you know, get a theme going, but I mean, obviously, I am definitely interested in very complex female protagonists. And that's just kind of like, we just haven't had enough of them. And I'm fascinated by a complex female protagonist and obviously there's a lot of queer sensibility in my work as a queer writer. So I think queering things up a little always helps, and I'm always game to do it. Usually, I will say there's one central question that I'm asking myself in any project, and you know, like working on I Love Dick, it was like, what's the nature of obsession? What does that do to you, and why, you know? In Chris Krause's case, you know, that was a story of a woman who needed to fully find her own voice, her own desire and sexual expression of that by becoming obsessed with another man and outside her marriage and yet bringing that inside her marriage. So I think that there's always like one kind of question, and I would just say and I hope it doesn't sound too flippant, but usually I'm attracted to projects or ideas that I have absolutely no idea how to do. So if I can see it, like, oh yeah, and then the second act is this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, it's probably not the right project, because there's nothing, there's going to be nothing that is going to keep me up gnashing about. So I think the impossibility of things makes for a lot of sense. So when I was talking earlier about, like, well, let's make a film that crawls inside the experience of what it would feel like to be in a Shirley Jackson story without actually being in a Shirley Jackson story, but having Shirley there with you, you know? I think that's for me too, I've been working a little bit in various genres, and the perversion of genre is always really interesting to me too. So I think there's ways in which people have been calling Shirley a psychological thriller, and yet there's many, many other aspects to it. And so I would say it's a perversion of a psychological thriller, and a perversion of our notions of what a biopic is as well.
Yeah. So the idea of do one thing each day that scares you, but as a career.
Yes.
That's fantastic. That sounds amazing. That sounds completely appropriate, because you're looking for something, right? That you don't understand, that you have to figure out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it. You know, I've said this a lot. I mean, I think, you know, I hate my work, but I love it, because it's really about curiosity and obsession and fascination, and with something that's completely made up. So yeah, I think that not really comprehending something is a source of stoking that curiosity.
What's stoking that curiosity right now for you? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple of things, but I'm working on another feature, and it's actually a feature that's based on a satirical novel. Let's just leave it at that. And I really haven't worked much in satire, so that's been really fun. Really, what just the ways in which, you know, satire is showing up at this particular moment, where it has been cinematically, and then what it means to have a satirical female protagonist. So,
Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. This has been a fantastic conversation, and we really appreciate you taking the time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you guys for your interest in the film. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we'll catch up with National Book Award-winning author Sigrid Nunez to discuss her recent novel, What Are You Going Through? Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.